Good morning, everyone. I'd like to introduce you to Elder Kelvin White and Ms. Arlene Blanchard, two leaders in the Mi'kmaq community in the Bay St. George area, Elder White from Flat Bay and Ms. Blanchard from Shallop Cove. Now, Arlene and I talked about the politics and pitfalls of being in small communities, so I hope I have that the Shallop Cove and the Flat Bay correct this time. Ms. Blanchard is the chair of the Bay St. George Mi'kmaq Cultural Revival Committee. And Elder White is a former chief and has been awarded both the Order of Newfoundland and the Order of Canada, and has a Doctor of Laws degree from Grenfell for his grassroots efforts in Indigenous recognition and rights in Newfoundland and Labrador. Both Ms. Blanchard and Elder White have been instrumental in guiding Grenfell's policies and practices regarding cooperative and collaborative research that involves members from the Grenfell community and members from the Indigenous communities. So they've been, I've been in one of the meetings with them, standing in for the Dean, and some of the information that I received, I heard at that meeting was fantastic stuff. So I think you guys are in for a really great presentation right now. So with that, I'm going to turn the virtual floor over to Ms. Blanchard and Elder White. Take it away. And so my camera's going to be turned off. It's not that I'm not listening.
Do you want to go first?
Or? Yeah, okay. Okay. So thank you very much for, first of all, the invitation and inviting us into your space today so that we can share some of our Indigenous worldview and some of the work we've been doing. Elder White and I have talked first, and I'll give you an overview of where, how we got to this place, and then he'll give you some history. So I chair the Bay St. George Mi'kmaq Cultural Revival Committee, and we've been in partnership with Grenfell University and Kelly Butler's office, the Indigenous Affairs Office, about creating some good work and moving forward for Indigenous research. And we consulted with community, both the Indigenous community and also the Grenfell community. And we've done three symposiums, and in these symposiums, we consulted with both the university and the Mi'kmaq community. And what we heard from our community, because we're representing the Mi'kmaq people, is that when researchers are doing research, we want you to engage in our Indigenous ways of knowing and doing. And in doing that, we want to build that relationship. So we don't want researchers just to come out and research us. We want to be a part of it from the start. So we want to form that relationship. We want ethical research. We want research that's being done on information and topics that we need research on. We don't want the university to just come out and research us more and not include us, because that's what's happened through colonization, and Elder White will talk more about that. But we'd also heard from our communities that we want to understand the benefit of that research and that relationship. So what the benefit may be for you as a student or a researcher may not be the same benefit that a community is looking at. So that benefit has to be a mutual agreed part of the research. So it has to have conversations, and that conversation has to come from having that relationship with the community and the Mi'kmaq people. So it all goes back to that relationship and that reciprocity of understanding why you're doing that good research. And when it comes to research and you're dealing with traditional knowledge and you're involving the communities, we also want to have that understanding that this knowledge is an Indigenous knowledge, and it's once we hand it over, it's not a part of the university or it's not yours to keep. It's a collaboration. So moving forward, anything that you do with that research should go back to the communities and say, is this okay to do this, or is that okay to move forward with it? And it's also important that you're capturing the words of the community. So if I tell you something, some piece of information, and you interpret it to mean something else, you should also go back to that community or that person to ensure that the words are being captured, because our words have been twisted before and it doesn't always end well. So it's important to really capture the wording of it. And research is so important. We understand that. But the research that you're doing, it's important that you don't cause any further harm or re-traumatization. It's about self-care as well for both parties. We want to do good work. And the more good work we do, the more researchers get funded, the more funding you get, the better off we all are as a community. So we want to really do the good work. We need academics in our world to prove points, facts. It's all about that two-eyed seeing approach that Elder Marshall has gifted us with. So I'll stop for a second and let Elder White go on and go from here.
Good morning. I thought what I would do today is I would impose myself on you to share a little bit of the history of why trust is so important when it comes to talking about collaboration on research. And I'll try to be very brief, although that's difficult for me, because I can go on and on and on. But in the respect for time, I'll try to be brief, but I think it's very important to talk a little bit about that history, because that's one of the components that has been overlooked. And if we and we'll go back to Aboriginal European contact, and we'll talk about our first engagement in collaboration. And our first engagement in collaboration was the negotiation and the signing of treaties. That would have been one of the very first engagement. And we all know the history, even those who don't want to admit it, but we know the history of what happened with the treaties. They were negotiated in good faith. However, the colonial perspective overrode any truth and honesty that appeared to be part of that negotiations. And then we moved on from that into what was a controlling factor over Aboriginal people's lives. And whether it be through the newfound religion that we adopted, which in our case was the Catholic Church, or whether it was the colonial governments that were put in place, it was one of oppression, totally oppression and dictatorship. What happened was, for a long period of time, our people felt that they were lesser than anybody else in society, and this continued for a long, long time. In fact, I'll be quite honest with you, even as a boy, and I'm 78 years of age, just turned that a couple of days ago, but even as a boy, I was intimidated by the sight of somebody with a shirt and a tie and a briefcase. Because when you displayed yourself in that present, you demanded authority. It wasn't about respect. It was about control. I've seen that in the schools. I've seen that in the very little interactions that I've had at a very, very early age. It was you were schooled and you were ridiculed, and then sometimes you were punished if somebody did something wrong and you told them they were wrong, because you weren't supposed to challenge anybody of any authority. Authority was dominant, and that happened with Aboriginal people here in Canada, not only in my community in Flat Bay and here in Newfoundland, but right across Canada. That was the happening. That one was taking place until sometime in the late 60s, early 70s, with the coming together of what was the first national organization was the National Indian Brotherhood. And the objective of that national organization, which later became what we have today as a national organization, the Assembly of First Nations, was about empowerment. It was about empowering people. And how you empower people by educating them. And in this particular case, the objective was to educate people about who we were, where we came from, and where we were going. And we used the self-evaluation of who am I, where am I, and where am I going. And when you do that as a self-evaluation, then you realize your responsibility as a human being, and in this particular instance, as an Aboriginal person, and what you're responsible for in your journey, which is a short journey, but in your journey of life, and what you should be doing. And that was a concept that was brought about as being something that needed to be talked about nationally, and was being promoted by the National Indian Brotherhood. We were somewhat successful in empowering people, but as we empowered people, we also encourage education as being the necessary tools. We realized that, you know, burning the houses, the shacks that you were living in, and going back to live into a birch bark wigwam wasn't practical anymore. First of all, because there wasn't a whole lot of birch rind to take anymore, because that had been, exploited. The forestry industry and everything else, the way of life was no longer feasible. You know, the attack on fur products it took the market away from us. So all of the things that had been practical as an Aboriginal way of life was being eroded and being moved away from us. The ability to be able to fish, whether it's for a food fishery or whether it was for a fishery that allowed you to generate some revenue for the things that you needed in society, that was under attack because most of our resources were given away to the larger fleets and given to European countries, either traded for the sale of meat or whatever the case may be. So all of those things became a reality to us that we never ever thought about before or never ever had to or ever had to question. The other thing that happened is that in organizing and putting in place new government structures, I'll call them, within the Aboriginal organization, because in our particular case, in the Mi'kmaq society, our governance structure was the Grand Council. Therefore, we had our planners and our thinkers and the people who provided the opportunities in the direction. Now we, because that also had been under attack, we needed a new norm. And the new norm, whether it was right or wrong, it's hard to say, but what happened was is that in order to be a player at the table, you had to adopt some of the colonial structures. So what happened was is that band councils were created with elections and chiefs and counselors, which is a kind of a semi-colonial structure, but still at the table you are embracing much of the traditional ways of life. As we did those things and as we learned about government and various other empowered institutes, we realized that knowing these things wasn't enough. Nobody was going to sit at the table and talk to you, because unfortunately the society we live in is that government structures don't move unless they're either embarrassed or forced to move. And in most cases, we need to and had to use the courts in order to solidify justice for ourselves and for our people. The Donald Marshall case is one example with regard to the fisheries. And I offer this more for the students to be able to conduct a type of research to either validate what I'm telling you or to be able to prove me wrong. But it's necessary to be able to challenge that. So when finding out how the government structures work, we realized that asking and hoping to be able to get to the table wasn't going to make any difference. So what happened was that there was another arm of that 70s movement, in addition to the political structure of the now Assembly of First Nations. What happened was that there was another group who became an active group, who became the people who were ready to go on the front line with regard to blocking the roads and blocking sites that were under attack for development and all of these type of things, and in some cases it got a little bit carried away, but it was a necessity, because goodwill wasn't there. When you invite government to the table and you want to talk about renegotiating the treaties, or you want to talk about new existing development of treaties, there was always a negative approach to it. Like they didn't want to talk to us; they wanted to talk about us, and that's not what we wanted. So what happened was is that the two arms of empowerment was moving forward. One being the power of the people by political structures and education. The other one was the power of people by demonstrations and bringing the issues in the spotlight. I'll stop on that, and I'll move now to where we are with regard to the new relationship that we see and that we've enjoyed, particularly here in Newfoundland. I only can talk about Newfoundland, and I only can talk about our involvement with the university over the last, I'd say, 5 years in particular, is that relationship has become very positive. However, as positive as it is, and as close that we have been with regard to being able to evaluate, we still see a higher bureaucracy there. We are by what they perceive as a loss of power, and we're very much aware of that, and we see that. And while we feel very free and comfortable to be able to speak like I can from my perspective, because I behold and am controlled by nobody, and everybody is equal in my thinking, we see that that's not yet practical within the bureaucracies of the university. We know that students are given assignments and given responsibilities, but they're also giving a template. And that template is not practical for many of the communities that you're going to work in and the people that you're going to work with. There are times when you need to be able to step outside of the template. And the students themselves find that very difficult, because they've been educated in a system of hierarchy, whereby everything has to be, you know, and I'm not suggesting that you can't bring in you shouldn't bring in your assignments on time and all of the requirements that are put there. That's not what I'm advocating. But what I'm saying is that there has to be lenience, especially when you're working in an Aboriginal community. Because in an Aboriginal community, the very first thing that you're going to be doing as a researcher is you're going to be earning the trust of those people. And the reason why it's so important to earn the trust of those people is because of the history that I've just shared with you. Like, it's very difficult for Aboriginal people to have any trust in colonial institutes, because colonial institutes, everything from our religious involvement to our legal involvement, has never treated us and what we perceive to be fair or with equity. There's always been a manipulation. In fact, many of our people believe that even the laws are written to be interpreted in the favor of the writers of the law and the promoters of the law. So we always say, and we're not the only people to say that, I'm sure that many non-Aboriginal people say and feel that too, is that the laws can be interpreted to protect those who write the laws. So with that kind of an opinion, whether it's right or wrong, it's very difficult for people to open up to strangers who will come to their communities to do research. Apart from that, what has happened in the past, there has been incidents that we have uncovered in the not too distant past, whereby researchers, ignoring the wishes or the involvement of the people, undertook research that was somewhat discriminatory to our people and created more trauma than anything else. Just as evidence, and whereby you can collaborate, what I'm telling you is that I'll share one example. Somewhere around in the mid 60s, maybe 63 or 1964. A couple of young researchers from Memorial University who were familiar with the West Coast of Newfoundland, that one or two of them being from the West Coast of Newfoundland, was given a research responsibility to come out and look at the agriculture potential of the Bay St. George area. Well, they came out and they did an awesome job into doing that. However, when they came to the community of Flat Bay, which is my community, they never talked about Aboriginal potential, about agriculture potential whatsoever. They talked about the deplorable conditions and the deplorable attitudes of the people in those communities. They talked about people living in shacks without stoves and having an oil cast for a stove. Well, in 1963, I was 21 years of age, and I had somebody come and talk to me. I could have took them to many, many homes who had decent stoves, who had really good running water with a pump, bringing well water into their house, who was doing quite well in society, didn't have a whole lot of money, but it wasn't about money, it was about survival. I could have showed them the majority of the people in our community who live like that. Instead, what they did is they choose to go knock on the door of the obvious shack that was by the side of the road, and then write the report on the deplorable conditions of that person who was socially and economically depressed without any other opportunity to be able to move forward. So there is a danger into opening your doors to people who come to research you. I've always said in the last 15, 20 years of my involvement is that we want people to talk to us, not about us. I'll conclude at this point in time now by saying that our experience have been somewhat really, really good. And our experience will go back, and I'll raise this. And sometimes people don't even want to hear about these things. But the university, some of the programs that it had in the past were very successful in empowering people in the communities. And I've lost my train of thought on the type of program, but I'm sure Fred will be able to contribute to that. I'm talking about the Neil Tillies and various other people who were assigned to work in communities. Extension services is what I'm looking for, the word extension service. The extension service program was a very productive program, and I'm sure that the empowerment of people, not only Aboriginal people, but the empowerment of rural Newfoundland can be contributed to that particular program, because that would have been the beginning of your rural service organizations, your agriculture development, your co-ops, all of these type of things. They were spawned by having the expertise of academics come into your communities, not to tell you what to do, but to ask you what you needed and to help you knock down some of the barriers in order to move forward. So it's about knocking down barriers, and it's about full collaboration. The one thing that we will not stand for, and I will advocate until my dying day, is that we don't want to be token Indians. We don't want to be to the table because it gives your proposal credibility to have an Aboriginal person sitting to the table. That's not going to happen under my watch. What we want to do is, if we're invited to the table, we want to be full participants to the table, as Arlene earlier articulated. I'll stop there for now, but I told you I could go on.
So just to reiterate a few of Calvin's points that he made there, it's very important that the university and the professors understand that when research is happening with Indigenous people and Indigenous communities, the students aren't going to be able to give you a full outline of the topics. They're not going to be able to give you a proposal until they actually meet with the community and develop that. And it could be a work in process. And the university has done a good job at that. And Brady Reed has done some really, really great work with the community of Flat Bay and Elder White. And Brady, when he first approached his professor, he was like, I can't give you a proposal topic. And luckily enough, this this professor was open to it. So you have to be brave enough as students to say, no, I can't do this yet when I'm doing research with Indigenous communities. You have to be brave enough to say, no, I need to let the Indigenous community lead this research project and I won't have my proposal until I meet with them. It's a brave step when you're doing university courses because it's your marking, it's your schooling, that's what you're relying on. And the other thing I want to highlight is that research projects doesn't always have to be writing. As Indigenous people, we believe art creation is a great way to express ourselves. We made wampum belts as agreements back in the day. Brady Reed did podcasts. It could be paintings. Art is an expression of who we are. So research topics sometimes may not be a actually written proposal. We've done the countries. It's a DVD project, which has a great deal of work in it, our histories, but it's a DVD. It's not a written document as well. So I just want to put that out there too, that all of our research doesn't have to be paper document. So maybe we'll just see it. Yeah, right. Questions and answers.
Bob, maybe you go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm going to throw my camera back on again. So warning. I asked you guys this before in the boardroom one time. And so I'm going to ask again, because a lot of your focus is on people coming in and doing research with Indigenous communities on Indigenous communities. But there's the other side of this too. There's the natural science side where people may want to come in and study rivers or the forests or the fish in the rivers or the birds in the forests in areas, regions, well, the whole West Coast, I suppose we could say. And so I asked you about this before. How does somebody who's doing the natural sciences work with the local Indigenous communities? So when it's not human oriented, but it's wildlife or fish or forest oriented, what's your take on that approach? I know your answer, but
that's absolutely necessary and welcome by people and by communities.